All right. Welcome to another episode of the Joe and Doug Show. We're pumped that you're with us. It's been a beautiful day here in Youngstown. We can't go into the show and talk about leadership or self-help or any of this stuff before we pause. And I don't even know if you've seen on the news. I know you've been crazy busy, but I caught it on the way here that 12 of our service members have died at the Kabul airport and another 15 are wounded. And we don't know how many Americans and Afghans. I hear there's a total of 60 dead. Really, really want this administration to like do something about it. I mean, there's obviously on our end, we're not getting on a plane and going over there and doing something about it, but like, it, I don't know, something rises up in you and it's an important thing. Like, you know, it's good for us to talk about finance and law of attraction and all that sort of stuff, but some things kind of take precedent. And that was one of those things that was aching my heart a little bit today. It's been pissing me off for a week or two now, but to see service members, we haven't lost a service member in 18 months. And then today we lose 12. It's just sad. So
yeah, for sure.
Our thoughts and prayers go out to their families and loved ones and those that are over there. And I hope they turn our soldiers loose and let them kick some tail.
Yep.
So with you. Yeah. So how is Joe?
Joe's good.
Good.
That's it.
So what really stirred me today is I had an amazing conversation this morning with a terrific organization that we should totally have her on our show.
Okay.
Her name's Judy, and she founded an organization called Heroes to Heroes. And what they do is they take war veterans, American war veterans, and they reconnect them to their faith with a trip to Israel. And just the story she was telling, she was such a dynamic thinker, speaker. And it's really fascinating because she deals with 99% of the people she deals with are Christian. And she is Jewish.
Interesting.
And so she's not trying to make them Jewish. She connects them to their Christian faith. And it's a very fascinating organization. She had some amazing, just inspirational stories. And it was super inspiring. And in light of what I just shared, it's a little, dose of hope.
Yeah.
After all, that was really good. Awesome. Yeah. We'll definitely have to make that connection happen, have her on the show. She was a ton of fun to talk to. And that was my morning. And then my afternoon, I'm doing a funeral today. So this is lots of heavy stuff. I'm doing a funeral on Saturday for one of our congregation members, Marinelle, who passed in January, and her family just waited until they had lots of family out of town. And with COVID and stuff, they waited, and we're doing a memorial service on Saturday. And she was just the sweetest, and 90, I think almost 90. And she hugged me and kissed me, even though I didn't want really to be hugged or kissed.
Generation.
Yeah, right? She heard me say from the platform multiple times, like, you know, I only hugged my dad at like my eighth grade graduation, my high school graduation, and my college graduation. That was the extent of the hugging that happened in our household. And she would tell me all the time that she was making up for lost years and lost hugs. So
nice.
Very sweet. I'm looking forward to honoring her. But so it's been kind of a heavy day for me, if that makes sense. But the news, and then, you know, prepping for a funeral, sometimes prepping for a funeral or memorial service like this. This one was enjoyable because she was such a sweet lady, lived such a full life, loved people. It's going to be an easy one to do. Like I like teared up while I was writing some of the stuff. So like, it's very potent and memorable. And then you do other ones and it's like, you're kind of like fishing for material because you didn't know the person that well, or you're like, well, I kind of got to lie about them. They really weren't that great of a person. And it's real tough when their own family's like, well, I'm like, tell me something exciting or good about them. And they're like,
and chewed bubble gum.
Yeah. And I'm like, give me something. So
do you have a topic? Cause I got something that I want to talk
about.
Yeah.
We can roll that way. I just needed to get the heaviness off.
Okay.
And then we can go whatever direction you want to go.
Okay. Well, this kind of connects it in roughly. So, I subscribe to sort of a philosophy discussion, listserv. And one of the topics of late was, sort of like plotting out what morality is and, you know, where, the view of like, if you, it used to be pretty easy that morality came from something.
Sure.
And in a secular society, like morality is like making it up on the fly and what feels good and what's changing, sort of like the abstractness of what morality has become.
Yeah.
Now, like, we're dealing with countries that, you know, totally play by a totally different rule book, right?
Yep.
What we think people behave and what their conditions are and what they believe in and whatever, totally different than what they actually are. So we kind of like, we put our state of mind and we try to connect with what's going on. And that's why it doesn't make much sense of it. So I want to talk about like the morality. And if you don't have a proper way of publishing out what morality even is, I mean, what is the North Star when you come to a secular society?
Yeah, there isn't one.
Wow, this discussion was
that's
quick.
Over. Ultimately, right, people will say, I'm my own authority. You can't tell me what to do. I can't tell you what to do. It's the ultimate libertarian kind of feel to morality is like, well, Joe is his own compass. Well, if Joe's a jerk, we're going to have a problem. So at some level, without an exterior guide to morality, and it's one of those interesting philosophical discussions you can get into with atheists or you can get into with people that, you know, secularists, humanists that are just kind of like, well, I'm the highest sense of good. Well, you don't have any incentive to do good. And they're like, well, I do good because you should do good. Well, why should you do good? And you just follow that train of thought.
So why are there people acting as if there were some underpinnings? Even if you say I'm secular, there's some things that you do for what reason?
Right, because it's built in. We've been made in the image of God. From that standpoint, Psalm 14 verse 1 says the fool says in his heart there is no God. And I love that line. That reminds me of a scripture. You can hit the little harp.
There we go.
the Bible says that the fool says in his heart there is no God. And I always love, you know, and I'm sure we'll get some flack from atheists and secularists and stuff like that. But it really is a decision of faith for them. And so even when you're in the most logical scientific state, at some level, when you get the most ardent evolutionary biologist in the corner and you get them to the point where, well, how did life begin? And they go, well, we don't know. It just bang, it happened. We can look at the laws and we can get back to that moment. But we really don't know what starts that moment. And then you start hearing evolutionary biologists say things like, perhaps life was seeded here by a superior species. Okay, perhaps it started on the back of crystals as a primordial soup and it got hit, and they start sounding like, wait, I thought you were a scientist. And that's the whole thing, is at some point, it doesn't matter what your logic is, whether we're talking about the creation of the world, whether we're talking morals, at some point you get to a spot where I have to make a leap of faith, whether that leap of faith is God, whether that leap of faith is alien seeded life here, whatever it is, at some level you're going to have to do that. And the morality side of things, the reason people have a natural built-in moral compass because we've been made in the image of God. And I think that explains why bad people do good things sometimes, why people that don't believe in God do good things. That moral compass is built in. Why kids have a conscience, you know, we use that sort of term that, why did you know that was bad? Or why did you feel bad about doing something? No one had to tell Abraham when he was two, and I told him not to do something, then he did it. No one had to tell him to hide it behind his back or feel bad about it. He naturally did. It's built in.
Right.
And you see that kind of across the board. And so I think some of that, you start getting into the creation ideas. And when you steer from that, though, and you say, well, there is no moral compass outside of myself, then I can kill you. Then society decides, and we all vote on it. Well, if you get enough bad people in on a vote, right?
Right. Well, and relativism is part of the crux of some of this discussion, because if you think like, you know, when we start comparing ourselves to what we think is good, and then it becomes sort of like a pseudo compass because we're comparing it to another individual. Like, I truly believe that, I don't know what's moving here. I don't know if I got smarter or the world got dumber. And I don't necessarily think it matters, because when you have the comparison between the two, is it moving away from you or are you moving towards it? I mean, did I become more moral or did the world just go to hell? That kind of a thing.
Well, it's so interesting because most people are craving the stability of an external morality. Most people are looking for that. They like the relativism when it suits them, but when they want justice, they want
absolutism.
Yeah. And so it's a very fascinating dichotomy that people end up in, because ultimately when you live in that relative, why does it matter? Call people racist or whatever. Well, it's relative. Like, why do you get to decide that? Well, no, that's absolute. Like, you don't get to play both sides of that coin. Like, either there's absolute morals that come from somewhere, or everything's relative and I can tell you to go suck wind and do what I want. And I think that's where people start to get into a space and it becomes very shaky ground, because when you get into some of this relativism stuff, they like it to be relative as long as it suits them. And then they want it to be absolute for you, as long as you should agree with their relative ideas. And if you don't, they're absolutely sure that you're wrong.
And so if you were to guess, like a prediction here, following this thread, do you think it resulted in like lots of things being unearthed and everybody got more enlightened because of it? Or do you think it decayed to the point where it turned into academics really calling each other names? Which do you think happened?
I think it's pretty obvious if you look around. But I think it's actually going to be the thing that swings the pendulum in the other direction.
For sure.
Is, you know, there's going to be a generation that comes up. There's going to be people that look at this and really see how silly it is, and the pendulum will swing back in the other direction. You'll end up with a new age of Puritans. You'll end up with some
or like interesting stuff. The bigger fear though is if the rest of the world doesn't subscribe to that traditionalism, where it's more like savage than it is civilized. What if the savages take a bigger section and it becomes more brutal instead of more civil?
It very well could. Some people would say that that's the direction the Bible tends to lead itself to prophetically, depending on who you talk to, that things are going to get worse before God comes back to stop it.
Well, I got to see if there's got to be like an alternate pressure that pushes back against that. Mm-hmm. And I don't like, I can't name it. I don't know what huge wave of non-brutal or more civil is happening.
Well, the thing is, it's supposed to be the church. I mean, in it being the pastor sitting at the table, the church has absolutely given away its authority and its leadership in every sphere. Where did all of scientific breakthroughs come from? Medicine, hospitals, all of that stuff started in the church. And then they gave it away and they secularized it and they said, oh, that's not for the church. You just do spiritual things on Sunday. And education all started in the church. All of the, you go and you look at the great universities, Harvard, all those were started as seminaries to train ministers. And then we gave it away. And we do that over and over and over again. And we end up with, well, you're just the spiritual people. Go sit in the corner and don't tell us about God. Just leave us alone. We're going to handle the science. We're going to handle the entertainment, the arts, all of that stuff, you know, is all birthed in the church a lot.
But if you add up Christian believers, they are the majority of all people. So you could decide if you wanted to not absolutely be the lack of influence that you have right now.
The number one issue that was driven at pastors in the last two elections, in 2012, when Barack Obama ran against Mitt Romney, it was something in the neighborhood of 25 million Christians stayed home.
Wow.
And they were like, the election wasn't decided by that much. If they just showed up, now they had an issue because Mitt Romney is a Mormon, and so they didn't count that in the evangelical sphere, and it's not, and I don't have time to get into the nuance of all that, but so there was a hang up there. And then when you come to 2016, right, Trump was an anomaly. A lot of Christians didn't know what to do with Trump. He split the church just about down the middle, because you had a lot of people that were like, this guy's an absolute scumbag personally, but he's espousing all this stuff over here. And he would try and talk in churches. And to be honest with you, some of it was just embarrassing. You know, I forget. I think he was at Liberty University or something like that. And he was like, my favorite verse, 2 Corinthians. I'm like, no Christian calls it 2 Corinthians, bro. And you know, he was, and I get it. And people were like, well, you know, he was trying to do his best to appeal to that part of the country. And was his faith genuine or not? Only God knows that. I'm not about to sit here and say that he was this, you know, stellar born again Christian, or that he was faking the whole thing. It could very well be very genuine, but the church had a problem. They were like, we don't know what to do with this guy. He espouses a lot of the stuff that we like from a policy standpoint, but we hate his personal moral compass. And then when he ran again, it was very difficult because you had a whole bunch of policies that we hated, and the church was in a spot, and a lot of people stayed home or they voted third party.
So what do you think then, if you know, like right now we're talking about, like, we're treating the Taliban like they're an actual, you know, whatever.
They're about a bunch of 8th century barbarian goat herders.
Yes. And so chop, like, people's heads off. Could you ever see, since obviously the church isn't carrying any of the influence and the secularists are dealing with the secularists and trying to infiltrate and put morals back into them, even if you don't have control of the hearts?
Well, but here's the whole thing, is like, eventually that system corrupts itself and falls when you don't have
underpinnings.
The underpinnings, you don't have, there's a scripture, Joe.
You're dealing me
I'm,
up.
I'm on fire today. That says, don't move the ancient boundary stones. I think it's in Proverbs. And, you know, and the idea being like those stones were put there on purpose. And a lot of times we come in and we go, well, that's stupid. Let's just move it around. And sometimes we need to advance stuff and move stuff. But there are certain pillars that are put in place that we're building society. And when you pull that out, you don't realize all the other things that are attached to it. And so I believe with all my heart that just look at Europe. I mean, you talk about, you know, a society that's gone secular for probably, I don't know, 50 to 100 years at least now. You know, you have country, whole countries, economies collapsing. You have all sorts of stuff, the social fabric. You have higher rates of all kinds of, you know, mental problems and different things like that, suicide, etc. And we're just following suit. We're a little bit behind them. But the further secular you go, the more you're looking for hope, the more you're looking for an absolute. And it opens up, you know, a harvest field for the church to actually step in and do what the church is designed to do. The problem is the church is too busy trying to impress a secular culture instead of being opposite the culture. Like, we're literally called to be counterculture. People are supposed to look at us and go, you're different. You don't do that like everybody else. Not different in a weird sense, but different in like a, that's like Jesus was attractive when he showed up. People were like, there's something about him that I want. And the church has spent a lot of time being weird. Everybody's like, I don't know if I want that. You're different, but different in a sense where people are looking at that going, why do you have peace when everybody else is running around? Why aren't you afraid when everybody else is terrified? Why aren't it like it's supposed to be juxtaposed to the culture, not just in the sense that like we don't drink, we don't dance, we don't smoke, we don't go to movies or whatever. Like they, you know, in the holy rollers in the 30s and 40s, you know, you had to sign cards and stuff when you went to church and you became a member of the church, Joe. You'd sign and say, you know, I'm not going to drink, I'm not going to go to the movies, I'm not going to play cards. They had all a whole list of don'ts, and that was the way that they were holy and separate from the world. We're going to be different than everybody else. And while there are things that God asks us to abstain from, and I'm not saying that list is what he asks us to abstain from, there are certain things that he says aren't good for us and aren't healthy for us. That's not what he meant by different. Different is I can walk into, you know, wherever, a bar, pick your spot, and I'm not going to be affected by the outside stuff. I can go into places, I can sit with other people, and they're not going to influence me. I'm going to influence them because the same spirit that raised Christ from the dead lives in me. And so when I walk into those places, I have a power that they don't. And too many Christians are terrified of that. And so we walk around and we're fighting with both hands tied behind our back. And everybody's like, why do we keep losing? Well, untie yourself and go in there with some, I'm preaching now.
That was good. And when I was reading this whole discussion, I was picturing you and like getting your take on it. So that's why I lobbed it out there.
Yeah, no, morality is one of those things that our culture claims to be an expert in, that it's just totally depraved. It doesn't have any compass with it. And it's always so, all you have to do is look at what's going on with gender and this whole idea. It's, they've removed any objective facts about it. Like we are like a dichotomous species. You're either male or female. Now there are a few abnormalities where people are born with both, but by and large, you're male or female. And in that sense, I can pull down your pants and I can tell you what gender you are. Now we can have a discussion about how you feel, but how you feel has zero to do with your biology and zero to do with how God made you. And so when you start getting into a conversation like that with people, and you pull the objective factor out, the Genesis one, where he says he made them male and female, God made them, and it says it right up front. And then we can see that in biology. When you pull that out of the mix, well, you get all kinds of depraved stuff. You get all kinds of weird stuff, and people can do whatever they want to do. And here's the thing, though. Like, you're free to do whatever you want. Like, you don't have to like what I'm saying. I'm just telling you that the world adds up and makes more sense this way. And so by all means, you can keep running in that direction, whether it's gender stuff, whether it's sexuality, it doesn't matter. The world will make up its own set of morals and they'll collapse because they're not built on the right thing.
Yeah. And even like acceptances and tolerances, those mean the meanings of those words have changed.
Totally
like,
different. Yeah.
You know, I'd like to feel that, you know, if anybody's in their pursuit, it's not up to me to like get Absolutely. In the way of their pursuit. Yep. So whatever you want to say to yourself or call yourself, it's only when, you know, I am being coerced into feeling differently exactly. than I do that you're impeding on, you know, my expression.
I've said multiple times, it's the United States of America. Two guys want to marry, two girls want to marry, all that sort of stuff. You just the government should just stay out of it, but don't demand that I sanction it, approve it, and have to do it at my church. Like it's not biblical. It goes against, I can give you, we don't have time to do all that on the show, but it's an abnormality and it's not designed that way. But here's the thing. You can tell me to go take a flying leap and do whatever you want.
Right.
Because this is America. And I'm not going to lose any sleep over it. And if you're my neighbor, I'm going to have you over for hot dogs and everything else. And we're going to have a good time. We've had plenty of gay couples that sit in our church. We've had people that struggle with gender stuff sit in our church. And that's fine. But I'm not changing because they're sitting in my church. I'm not deviating from the truth just because you're sitting here. We'll love you and treat you just like everybody else. You can come to the church picnic. You can worship with us, all of that. But you need to understand that we have a set of values, and that's not going to tweak because you're sitting here.
Okay. So, but
should I run for office after this?
This is good because I'm thinking, like, you know, I do something stupid, right? Yeah. And then you're allowed to think and say, "Hey, Joe, that was stupid." Sure. And then I'm allowed to say that you're mean for thinking that I'm stupid. Yeah. It just can go back around for infinity. But there's no, like, if we keep expressing our freedoms, again, you find some truth in whatever it is. But we don't have to come to an understanding. We don't have to come to one, you not being mean and me not being stupid.
But, and here's the thing. I have one of my roommates that I went to Bible school with. He and I are on opposite ends of the political spectrum of a few things. And we've had some great discussions, he and I. And we can leave those discussions. And I still have a ton of respect for him. And I still think the world of him. He's a great husband, great dad, like all those things. I just disagree on that approach. And he disagrees with me. And that is greatly missing in our society. To be able to live next door to somebody who worships different than you or doesn't worship at all and be able to have hot dogs and, you know, have them over for, you know, a cookout in the summer and then not sit there and rag on each other because, well, you vote. Like, everything's become so polarizing, so political, so separating. Like, we used to be able to be like, yeah, you know what, we're all Americans and we all, you know, come on over, we're having a block party. It doesn't matter where you work, doesn't matter how much money you have, doesn't matter where you worship. Like, that we had a common thread, and that common thread's gone. And the more it deteriorates, the worse it's going to get.
All right. Now, did you have an actual topic for this? And I derailed it with this.
No, I was,
I was just going to wing it.
I was coming in hot off of the football feeds at the church, and I had a very full day. And so driving in, I'm like, "Lord, give Joe a topic."
Really? You planted that in my skull. That was weird.
I was scraping for a topic today throughat the day. And I had started jotting a few things down in a note, and but on the way here, I was just like,
this again, we just perpetuate some darkness. So let's do a little bit lighter, and let's find some hope in this. Like,
absolutely.
What you said is that, you know, the pendulum swings, and it's going to get better before, or it's going to get worse before it gets better. So, you know, on the other side, I mean, you're not a doomsayer. You don't see that this is an end of the world. This is a rebound. We're going to rebound.
Yep. Yeah, so there's three things that have to happen. First of all, everybody has to understand that the person that lives at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue is not the hope of the world. I say that at church. I said that when Donald Trump was in the office. I said it when Barack Obama was in the office. I said it when George Bush was in the office. I have been consistent with that fact. The president is a very influential person, but he has zero bearing on what I'm going to do as an individual, what I'm going to do with my kids, what I'm going to do with my business. He may pass, you know, he may sign bills into law. You know, we could get into that, but people need to understand and devalue the political arena. It has to come down some rungs so that we don't even care who the president is. What's more important is the culture of Main Street, the culture of a town, the culture of people, and people coming together to have a fabric that's different. I mean, growing up in New Jersey versus being here in Ohio, there were two different fabrics. There were things that were important, and there were tangible things. Like, when I came to Youngstown from the East Coast, there were like two or three things that I was like, wow, that's different. Like, there's a blue collarness here. Like, you know, the way my dad, you know, fixed things at the house was like, "Hey, can you come over? How much will that be?" You know, and here they're like, "Whoa, Uncle Ted's cousin is a plumber. We'll call him. He'll come right over. It's 9 o'clock at night and he's in your basement." There's just a different sense of things here. Like, or, "Hey, we're going to figure it out. We're going to go Home Depot and buy the tools and we're going to figure out how to do it." There's a grittiness and a hands-onness, but that's a cultural fabric of this region. And some of them are good and some of them are bad. There's, you know, there's definitely an optimism on the East Coast that's different than here. You know, when I came here, I felt like everybody wanted to leave and like the other shoe was going to drop. And then I met somebody like Joe and I'm like, thank God I'm not the only one that wants to live here. You know, so you have that. So culture has to be elevated. Education has to be elevated.
Well, let me stop you there. So like, you know, when we talk about like how we talk about ourselves and the culture and what we renown and what, you know, what we pummel, you know, like I was always sickened when in, you know, television shows and whatever, the father in everything is the laughing stock and the joke, idiot. Right?
Yeah, and the dog's the hero.
And so that has like an effect on what permeates down to, you know, to real 100%. Life. We do that a lot with the things that should be. So what's going to elevate things that should be elevated, you know what I mean, in regular culture, if, you know, politics is not going to do it, the church doesn't have influence and the secular one doesn't have any need to have it done.
Culture's grassroots. So, you know, culture begins in the home. It begins in the family. It begins with your community, your schools. It's why I coach U8 soccer. As much as I can get the kids to run in one direction and score some goals, I want to make an influence on those kids. I want to help those kids know that, you know, there are adults that believe in them. There are good people out there. Like just small, subtle things. I have coached now. This is my fourth year. And I took 1 year off. So this is my third year with 1 year where I didn't because I had too many kids on too many different teams and I had to be in different places. But I want to be in that space because I know that out of three teams, never once was a negative thing spoken on the field. Like everything was like, oh, you did a great job. You're going to get it. You know, I ask every kid before the game, like, you feeling like a goal today? You believe you can get a goal and try and put them in positions to do some things just so they believe in themselves a little bit more. And those are small things, but it's so cool to me. I have them for, I don't know, 6-8 weeks. And when I see the kids now, they'll run up and high five me. Hey, coach, how are you? Some of them like, I forget your name, but hey, those are the small things. We have to be engaged in those processes. You know, I had a meeting this morning with the superintendent of schools. I spent about 40 minutes, came to my office and we talked through some things because I sent some things that were concerning to me about Boardman's mask mandate. And but having those conversations, being involved, being engaged, in the local stuff is important because that's what counts. And that's what really matters is shaping your town, your city. That's where you're going to build culture. Hollywood's going to do what Hollywood's going to do. Yeah. Social media, YouTube, all of that stuff. And you can certainly be on and doing stuff like we're doing, but, you know, that's, kind of like pissing on a forest fire.
Yeah. And truly sense. Like the people that are of equal stature, that they have an equal audience, that they do have some influence. They're not going to say like one side can't say it and the other side can't be loud enough. And so even though you have equal people balanced, that the culture won't support the opposition or the fight or the, you know, the debate.
Well, you chip away. It's like the kid on the beach with his grandfather. And all these starfish had washed up and, you know, the grandfather's like, oh, man, all these starfish are going to die. And the kid starts throwing starfish back and he goes, what are you doing? And we're going to get all these back in the water. And he goes, yeah, but I can save this one and I can save this one. And the kid just kept throwing them. And it's that sort of mentality that like, hey, you know, you're not going to turn the Titanic on a dime, but you can turn it 1 degree at a time. You know, you talk about all the time, 1 yard at a time, like you just have to move the ball a little bit. And so it's getting into these spaces and culture. It's starting businesses that have, you know, a different, culture that goes against what everything and being able, to stand up when stuff gets tough. I mean, that culture's shifted. You know, we talk about it in terms of church. If you want to shift your church culture shifted by the stories you tell and the heroes you create. And so if you can tell inspiring stories about people in your congregation and you elevate them, people go, oh, you know, they got celebrated because they served extra or whatever. And then the inspiring stories, you tell, those two things tell people what's important. That's why movies and TV and all that stuff is important because they're creating heroes and they're creating stories. You know, the most dangerous thing going on right now is the, I don't know if you've seen any of the remake of the Marvel stuff. Where they're throwing all this woke stuff all that stuff. And why are they doing that? Because that's how you shift culture, heroes and stories. So culture is important. Education is hugely paramount. And I haven't realized it until like, I feel like this is the first year all four of mine are in school and I'm recognizing more and more that like what my kids learn and not just what they learn, but who's teaching them, what and the content, I can only do so much as a parent. You know, I can bring them to church for an hour a week, but they're going to school for 6, 7, 8 hours a day, extracurriculars, all that stuff. Who gets the influence there? And so we have to be involved in that space. You know, we need more people with a moral compass to be teachers and stuff like that. We need more people. And I'm not saying that all teachers are bad or anything like that. There's some great teachers. I'm very excited for Charlotte's teacher this year. She's very sweet. We just met her. And, you know, just all of that to say, we're going to have to engage in some areas where we've been asleep at the wheel. And that, and that's the whole thing, is we're just asleep.
Here's another thing too. I think I'm a little bit of this problem, and, you know, risk reward calculations, if you step out and, you know, does your team support you when it gets hot? Right.
Yeah.
And I don't feel like there's enough courage in that to, you know, to support it. So I think a lot of people would toe it out there a little bit and say, okay, if this goes south, right, what's the outlook? Really dire. If it doesn't go south, what's the outlook? Way better, right? Yeah. And it's easier to choose the one, especially if you don't feel like you have a team around you, you have support behind you, and have the courage to you know, to support you.
But I mean, that's the beauty of moral convictions. And when you have an exterior moral source, it doesn't matter what everybody else thinks. You know, people say all the time, like, you know, I just need me and God, and that's a majority, right? No, God doesn't need anybody. It is what he says it is. And whether you agree with him or not, he doesn't care. It's a reality on the ground. And so, you know, 60%, 80% of the country can believe one thing. I'm going to stand over here.
Right. Well, and I know that's with you, but if we have somebody who is teetering, well, maybe they don't have the convictions that allow them to step out like that, but we need that person to have more faith. That person has to be more, you know, we see examples of, I want to use like Mike Lindell. He was one of those ones. Yeah. I don't know any what thing went down, but I know that he got pretty canceled by a lot of people. And
my wife and I bought my pillows intentionally because everyone.
Well, and that's the community rallying around somebody who, you know, he couldn't be silenced. He couldn't be tossed out like
that.
And
he's got a crazy cool story. I don't know if you ever heard his story. He was like a total like crack addict, like way out there, came to faith in the Lord. And then he's been the successful entrepreneur and stuff like that. It's super short version, but really powerful story of redemption. And he does a ton to help with charities and different stuff like that. He's a real like inspiring figure in that. And you know, obviously he has his political convictions and doesn't mind speaking out. You know, but it's always interesting when you do that and you put your neck on the line and you're saying about those people that are teetering. I think this is where strategy is important. And I've come to this conclusion like yesterday. This is a huge conclusion.
Okay.
So on the left side of the aisle, they all will buy in lockstep to their party line, whatever it is, even if they really don't agree with it, they're in. It's very rare that you have people deviate. Every once in a while you do, but it's just to save political skin. It's not a principle thing. The only reason Joe Manchin is because he's in a state that voted for Trump by like 97 points and he can't move off of certain things.
Bill Maher is the outlier.
Right. So here's the thing. On the left, you have pretty much everybody in lockstep. But on the right, the whole premise of the right is we have some libertarians and we have some neocons and we have Tea Partiers and we have fiscal conservatives. And you have this whole spread and gambit of folks, and at the core is individual liberty. So, you know, when you look at something, for instance, the repeal of Obamacare, everybody's like, oh, they couldn't get it done. They all wanted to do it, but they all disagreed on how, and everybody took their individual liberty and nobody jumped on the party train to do it. And so it couldn't get done. And I think that that individual liberty side of things is the thing that keeps, it does two things. One, libertarians don't like to get involved because they just want to be left alone. And then you have the rest of the kind of right side of the conservative movement all have different kind of, you know, spaces, priorities for their policy agenda and other stuff. So it's super important that we understand how we're navigating this so that the left will push stuff through. And the right will get stuck and everybody like, oh, they can't get it done. You know, they had the presidency, the House and the Senate, and everybody got all frustrated with that. Well, it's because they have this individual liberty over here where you have much more of a monochromatic kind of thought process on the left.
Yeah. And I think when we talk about unity then is trying to get everybody who disagrees to somehow get on the same page. But maybe that unity is a more like the Mike Lindell, like you say, if you step out and fight for these principles, we got your back no matter what.
Right.
And then more people would be willing to know that somebody's out there.
Well, and so often it's thinking through the argument before you make it. So right now the hot topic, right, is mask, no mask, vaccine, no vaccine, right? Mm-hmm. So the argument for masks, people will say, well, you know, it protects from the virus, it's going to keep us safe. They rattle off all these talking points. And then people on the other side say, well, virus isn't really that bad, especially amongst kids. Kids certainly shouldn't have to wear them. Only 360 kids have died in the last little bit. We never masked up for the flu, and twice that many died of the flu. Both sides make these arguments. And the problem is they're talking past each other. The argument that needs to be made, as a parent, I deserve the choice to make, to decide what my child does. Because you'll get some people that believe masks work that'll go, you know what? As a parent, I want a choice over my kid's health. And you're going to have people over here. It doesn't matter if they disagree on the efficacies of masks and how that works. But that takes a layer of thinking up to go, well, maybe this is a parent's choice argument, not a mask argument. And maybe that's the argument that needs to be laid out. And then we create allies instead of foes. Instead of yelling facts at each other that everybody disagrees with, we start going, well, don't you want the right to be able to pick what your kid does? Well, yeah, I kind of do. I think they should wear a mask, and I think your kid should wear a mask, but I think I should be able to pick for my kid. Well, me too. And so just because we disagree about the end of that, I think we should fight together for our ability.
Unity of protocol or language rather than unity as everybody agrees.
Exactly. Because you're never going to have 100% agreement. Right. Especially when it comes to moral stuff, even when we had the moral fabric of the Judeo-Christian values and stuff like that, you still didn't have people that agree. We had slavery, for crying out loud.
Right.
Like, you had half the country that justified that with the Bible, and the other half thought it was abhorrent. And you had, so even when you have that moral fiber, at least gives you a basis to make an argument from, but you're still going to have disagreements along there. I mean, there's disagreements in the church on a number of different.
Yeah. And what I hate most about what we've constructed is it's, even if you're a reasonable person, there's so many asterisks and exclusions.
Yeah.
Instead of following a principle and saying, no killing, right? Mm-hmm. Well, what about, you know, that kind of a thing? And so you can't establish something that everybody can kind of hang their hat on,
right,
where, like, do we steal, right? Stealing bad no matter what. And like, well, what if you're hungry? And, you know, all of these little exemptions make it a contortionist of whether or not, you know, that sin is somehow justified and it's allowable.
Well, I mean, look at something like drugs, right? So when you look at drugs, obviously the abuse of drugs leads to horrible things. Overdose, the opioid crisis, no justification for that being a good or healthy thing. However, there are some great uses for opiates within the confines of the medical community. There's some great uses, medical uses for marijuana. There's great, like you can see all these things inside the confines and context of a healthy thing. And then once it's taken outside of that, it becomes unhealthy. And so what do we do? Well, we're afraid that everybody's going to take it outside that context. So ban, prison, gone, all this stuff. And we end up stigmatizing, and we end up pushing this in a way that, and then we make the moral argument, and the right's done this too, where, you know, the whole war on drugs and everything like that, and you put a certain stigmatism on it, you do all the things that come with that, and then now we have this crisis where we have more drugs now than ever. We have more people in prison for drugs than ever. So, I mean, we've created other problems with this, and the thing we did didn't solve it, and nobody can stop and say, hey, that didn't work.
Right.
Can we do something else? Because we've turned it into a moral absolute.
Yes.
As a pastor, I can't campaign or petition or whatever and say, well, maybe there's another way. And they'll say, well, he's pro-drugs. Well, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying what we did here didn't work, and there's got to be a different way. But the moment you step outside of what's the acceptable moral norms, crucify him. Right. I mean, that's what ends up happening. And so to even enter those conversations, you have to do it under the dark of night. Like, hey, I'm not really here, but I'll give you my 2 cents. And because that's both sides of the aisle.
And
because
it still doesn't untangle it. You can even put your stuff out there, and there's nothing that comes on. You know, these academics that are talking about morality, there was nothing that came of it because everything was rhetorical. There wasn't one person who was talking to get an understanding. It was talking to preach and talking past each other, like your mask example.
Yeah, no, and that's the whole thing, is we're speaking to respond. We're not listening to the other side. And I'm guilty of this as much as the person next to me, to pause and go, all right, there's a reason they're making this argument. And if I listen to their words carefully and I listen to where they're coming from, I should be able to deduce what the issue is. Because a lot of times these are just symptoms. They're not the root.
Okay, so that's what we should do, is that we should dig through an issue and find out what the governing principle is,
right.
And then we can agree simpler on something that is a little bit easier understanding. So now,
100%.
Not listening to other person, what principle could be eroded or missing, right, that we should get back to, that we could both agree to? I would say that empathy would be a principle where if I'm genuinely interested in you or caring about you, I would want to know what was coming out of your noise hole, right? So that I can get a better understanding with you, right?
Well, why should you care?
Right.
That's what I'm getting at.
Right.
Unless there's a moral higher ground, unless there's a moral authority that says I should care about Joe because he's made in the image of God, and I should care about what comes out of his mouth because it's inherently valuable. Unless I have that, why do I care?
Yeah, then it's I'm here to beat you and win
or I'm here to gain some sort of advantage. The only reason I care what comes out of Joe's mouth is because I want an advantage in business. I want to be able to do this, or it all comes back to selfish motivations or fear. I'm afraid Joe's going to take from me. I'm afraid Joe's going to do this. So I'm only listening to defend.
This sounds a lot like the profile of a savage, right? With the schooling of getting the leveraging the primitive instincts of survival.
Yeah, I mean, there's a very thin veneer between civilized society and uncivilized society. And you saw it with the riots. You saw it anytime there's a natural disaster, people loot, steal, do all sorts of horrible things, because that civilized society is just there a little bit. The moment you start moving some of these elements, it goes downhill very quick.
Zombie apocalypse, bunch of people die, and it goes to tribalism and murder and stealing resources.
Speaking of zombies, I saw your quote about The Walking Dead.
It was bad.
Are you disappointed?
I'm really, really disappointed.
I mean, how long can you do zombies then becomes the question.
I know, but there's some ways that you can take it that doesn't deviate from the spirit of zombieism, right? that you could have gone, but it's the same storyline over and over again.
That shows a great example of what we're talking about. The degradation and the degradation of society as it comes down, what people are capable of always surprises people, but it shouldn't.
Well, and there were societies, like some of them banded together through, you know, fear and just being that savage. Mm-hmm. And some communities came together
as trying to be good.
Whatever. And the weaker societies were the ones that cooperated, and the stronger societies were the ones that had, you know, the biggest weapons. And so, yeah, that's an analog for what is happening on the outside.
To quote Bruce Lee, the story goes something like this. He had a student, and, the student said, you know, if you're, I think he was a Buddhist or something like that, but he says, if you're always, you know, talking about peace and tranquility, like, why are you teaching people to be warriors? And Bruce Lee responded, better to be a warrior in a garden than a gardener in a war. And I love that quote.
Yeah.
And it's very true. Like, Jordan Peterson says all the time that, you know, men should be dangerous. They should just be under control. And we keep trying to make men puny because we're afraid they won't control themselves. But the best thing a man can be is dangerous and completely under control. And that's
good.
It's totally true. You know, when you look at some of these Navy SEALs and some of these guys, I mean, they're bad dudes. Like, they if they wanted to, they could end you several different ways, but they're under control. And they've learned to harness the beast. And there's power in that. I saw the one guy, he was super, he was on the Bin Laden raid team in Afghanistan, and they were interviewing him, asking, you know, like, what should happen early on when they were trying to evacuate Americans. And he's like, give me 9 guys and I will kill everything in my path and get every American out of there. And like, he was just talking with this conviction. Yes. I'm like, that guy.
Remember movies used to be like that?
Yeah.
All right. Good show. All right, guys. Thank you for joining us. Good discussion. We'll be returning again on Tuesday for the Joe and Doug Show.
Thank you for listening to this show on Youngstown Studio. If you like our programming, we invite you to subscribe to our YouTube channel, follow our Facebook page, or subscribe to your favorite podcast platform like iTunes or Spotify. This is original Youngstown content, and we would appreciate you sharing the videos and the word about us. Thank you.